An old friend to River Styx magazine, and no stranger to this podium, poet Rodney Jones, described Stacy Lynn Brown's book perfectly, saying the poet, quote, knows that great emotional complexity requires simplicity, and she knows, too, when to get the tropes out of the way of the main story. She writes sparely and lucidly of sacrifice, privilege, and guilt, of what a mother is and what a muse is. With Cradle Song, she accomplishes a book-length narrative poem that seems to me one of our most compelling documents on race, family, and cultural identity. End quote. I'd like to add a few things so Stacy doesn't have to waste time explaining. Cradle Song, right here, is in many ways a book-length elegy for her nanny, Gaither, which I thought was pronounced Gator, which is probably more appropriate to the personality of this person, as you will discover. But Gaither, a black woman who raised her, nursed her, inspired her, and entertained her, among many other things. The book is also an elegy for Gaither's daughter, Pumpkin, who died in an auto accident as a very young girl. The book seems to be an elegy to the South, or more specifically, the poet's South, as well as her Southern girlhood, with all its wonders and horrors. Finally, Cradle Song is, in many ways, a lullaby to the poet's daughter, with stories passed on from the woman who raised her through the woman the poet has now become and now imparted to the next generation, and luckily, to us as well. Finally, and I can't believe Rodney didn't mention this, but Cradle Song is not only a moving book that deals with race and loss, privilege and guilt, but it is also very funny. It's been a long time since a poetry book made me laugh out loud, but Stacy's mother, and most especially Gaither, compare a rare kind of understated Southern humor, or capture a rare kind of understated Southern humor that will also be passed down for generations. Stacy Lynn Brown was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and studied at Emory University, Oxford University, and the University of Oregon. Her poems, essays, and reviews have appeared in various journals and anthologies, including Anti, Crab Orchard Review, Natural Bridge, Sou'wester, and Southern Quarterly. Several poems from Cradle Song were winners of the 14th Annual Poetry Center of Chicago Juried Reading Series. She teaches creative writing at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Please welcome one of our newest neighbors to the St. Louis poetry community and to this podium at Duff's, Stacy Lynn Brown.
Hi, thank you. Is that okay? Everyone can hear? All right, thank you. First of all, thank you to River Styx, to Richard, to Michael, to everyone, Jessica, everyone who works with it for having me, inviting me, including me in this. This is really special for me for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that I'm reading with Brian Turner, who is one of my oldest and closest poetry friends. We went to graduate school together in the 90s, and the last time we read together was at our master's thesis reading in 96. So, yeah, you won't hear any of the same poems from there. And I'm hoping this is... Well, anyway, it is what it is. But, yeah, so this is a book-length poem in sections. It is about sort of the South and a lot of its complexities. The South is a really curious place. It's a place of kind of beautiful difficulties. There are people there who are capable of tremendous kindnesses, and there are also tremendously ugly things that are deeply entrenched, prejudice, racism. And as a child growing up, I thought that was just kind of, you know, everything's crazy when you're growing up, right? Things always seem weird. And it wasn't until I left the South that I realized how specific to that area some of these dynamics were. And one of the complexities that that came at me was that I lived in a family that was there was racism in my family. And at the same time, there was this woman, her name was Gaither, and she was invited into our home, and she was given this sort of daunting responsibility of dealing with me and my sister day in and day out. And it was a pretty complicated situation because there was, like I said, there was this racism, and there was this woman. I was getting all these conflicting messages thrown at me all at once. And so when I left the South, I started sort of seeing it from a distance, and I started seeing it in a new way. And this book is sort of trying to wrestle with some of those issues. And since it's a book-length poem in sections, none of the individual sections have titles. And when I first started reading from it, I would say, like, 22 or whatever the title of the section number, but it's just really unsexy to introduce math into the whole equation. So I'm just going to tell it like it is. It's just a story, and I'm just going to sort of roll with it. So anyway, here we go. When I was 4, we drove to Nashville, Grand Ole Opry bound, and stopped the night at a broken-down motel in Tennessee. Shag walls, mossy carpet, dank concrete. And I remember standing in the doorway as evening fell, a bus full of believers rattling their way to the pool for a makeshift baptism, the amens and hear us, lords, ricocheting through the courtyard as underwater lights glowed the pool algae green. They would come to him, the big preacher man, and he'd lay a palm across their foreheads, brace them at the small of their backs. They'd release themselves to him, teeth sucking the air before falling back into salvation, held under, unstruggling, and splashing up anew, all gasping grace and sanctified glory, hallelujah, till my mother shut the door and made me watch TV. My parents don't recall it, but that's the way memory works in the South. The truth is always lying in some field somewhere between the bones of the fallen and the weapons they reach for. Is there a little beeping? Can you guys hear? It's like beep, beep. And I'm like trying to get in sync with it, but it's not happening. So if I start like bouncing and bobbing and weaving. One of the many curious and strange things about the South is the religion thing. Like, there are so many different types of churches, and it seems like all you really need to be a church is a van and some spray paint, right? And it's like, they have these names, like, you'll see them barreling down the highways, like, you know, the Mount Carmel Tabernacle Holy Church of the Apostolic Divination of Latter-day Saints Tree Hill, or whatever, you know, and they're always heading to, like, Six Flags or Stone Mountain or something. And I was always really intrigued by it, and I went to a lot of different churches because I was struck by how vastly different they were, all sort of under the same aegis of religion, but they're very, very different. And so this poem kind of came out of that. Down south, all it takes to be a church are some stencils and a van, and my childhood was full of them. The Episcopal litanies of Sunday school, exercises and genuflection, the Low Country Southern Baptist pit of hellfire and damnation hemming us inside the tent, while just outside, flies hover buzzed above plattered chicken, slaw, and beans. Prophets profiteering in spoken tongues as the charismatic wailed and thrashed and shook their Babel babble down. In dirt-floored shacks, fevered believers dance themselves into a frenzy, coiling snakes like copper bracelets dangling from their wrists, spit-cracked lips and boot heel clog, the baseline itself almost enough to give you back your faith. Grape juice and Dixie cups, cardboard host, backwashed wine, this grit who'd been told to be still and learn was never any closer to God. Then when I stood at the back of that whitewashed clapboard AME I could only ever visit, the preacher pacing the worn strip of rug, pleading, help us, Lord, teach us how to love, sending testified ripples that washed over heads, nodding bobs on the waves of his words, the choir rocking, feet stomping, peace only to be found in the swing skirt of shimmy and the big-bellied voices booming it holy in the gospel of move and you shall know. Sway. If you would or could not do for yourself, you hired a nanny or wet nurse, cat-eyed gaither rolling in each day to take up my bundled being and soothe me, sustenance. She raised me, balling my fist to teach me to fight, shaming my hips loose so I could shimmy, count cards, ante up, winner takes all dozen, your mama's so uglies, on home. All of my childhood's most important lessons, taught between ducked out drags of Salem's and Kool's. I answered only to her name for me, big-legged mama, in servitude to her, gratefully. Some of the poems, some of the sections are in other voices, and Gaither's is a voice that I tried for a long time to write about Gaither, and then every time I did, I found that she was kind of punching out the margins of whatever I tried to do because I was trying to summarize her or talk about her. And so what I decided to do was just write what I remembered her saying to me, her stories, my memories of her stories. So this is the first of those. And it's got a label, Gaither Memory Number 42. This one time, back when I was drinking, I was sitting up on the porch and this old so-and-so asked me, could she have a drink in my bag? And I says, have? Didn't nobody done let me have this here bottle? Why should I let you have any of it? Get your own damn bottle, you old so-and-so. And that old lady commenced to hollering at me and fussing, and she come up at me. But I had my sister, see, what's got about a 6-inch blade. So I got my sister out of my sock, and I started to cutting that old lady up, just hooking it in, before I realized I'd better get on out of there. So I run over to a friend's what had a place where she was staying at near there. She wouldn't open up the door for me. Just open it enough for her to see me through that chain, then shut it back again. So I went on my home, and I changed my clothes, and then I went back to that busy's house and did the same damn thing to her. Your daddy bailed me out of the jail that night, but he didn't know what for. What happened to that first lady you cut up, Gate? She didn't ever walk again. One of the instances of collateral damage in any situation like that is so many people who work in other people's homes leave their own families to do this. And Gaither had a child. Her name was Pumpkin. And it, even at the time, as a very small child, I was cognizant of this fact that she was in my house with me and Pumpkin was somewhere else. And so there are several poems in the book addressed to Pumpkin and sort of trying to reckon with these feelings and this dynamic. And this is the first of those poems for Pumpkin. Forgive me, Pumpkin, Gaither's true daughter, for taking her from you before the sun rose every day and returning her spent at night. I didn't know anyone could love or need her more than I did those 5 days of your motherless week. For those of you who are following along, this is number 7. Excuse me. Kristen clogged to Rocky Top at her wedding, didn't want her baby born a Yankee, so took a slow train south in the dusk of her 9th month. Virginia, born in the squalling drawl of Mama. I left my accent in a gas station in Kansas on the move out west. Too much time spent in front of audiences beaming back sympathy for the slow-wittedness implicit in my speech. I didn't catch what she was saying, but didn't her words taste sweet? Now, it only ever comes out when I'm back home or drunk or just plain mad. You better watch the combination of all three. The knock-kneed grit rearing up, skunk drunk, palms fisted for the rain of blows to come. This one also has a label. Gaither's vacation postcard to her husband, number 1. Dear Moose, I ain't never seen so much water, and I can't even swim. I never met the man, but my mother says his back was like a Tennessee road map, all scars and cratered gashes where Gaither'd put the hurt on him. That trip was her first vacation with us, the first time she'd seen the ocean, the last time she'd ever eat in public with my family. At a little cafe in Alabama, she heard what people had to say about her, sitting at our table like she belonged. After that, she'd always cook meals for herself at home. My mother tried to tell her, just ignore them, Gaither, they're ignorant. But white folks cannot fix by night what they break in the light of day. And it's a luxury of race to believe that race is not an issue. Keeping us is what they called it. Someone else in charge, in possession, in lieu, as if we were theirs to give. My father had a nanny. His father had a leather pouch and the shoes on his feet when he came down from the foothills of North Georgia to live with Aunt Lola in the city. My mother had a back injury. Her mother had a man to do her bidding, a son who never left home, the Lord, and a pride that kept them all writhing. Gaither was a natural choice. She had leathered hands and woven braids and an intolerance for tolerance. She smelled like sweat and tobacco and linseed oil and was given us, as if we could be given back. I'm going to read one of the sections that I've never actually read before because it has some backstory to it. It's about Stone Mountain. Does anyone know about Stone Mountain? It's like the largest outcropping of granite in the world. And so they, the people of Georgia in their infinite wisdom, decided to make a memorial out of it. And they decided to memorialize the Confederacy, right? Like the lost cause. Yeah, nothing like, you know, carving the losers onto a big rock. And so it became this like magnet for every, you know, sort of hillbilly within like a 200-mile radius. And they would all like circle it when they're stomper 4x4s and yee-haw, you know, doing the rebel yell and waving the stars and bars and all this kind of stuff. And then they literally carved Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson in huge relief on the side of this. And this mountain, this granite mountain, was a holy place for the Cherokee. But whatever, you know, is yee-haw. So then they, when laser shows were new technology, they decided to put a laser show and added to the thing. And it was back when like, all they could do really was do like triangles zooming in and out to like, you know, a fifth of Beethoven, you know, like that kind of stuff. And so we'd be like, woohoo, you know. And then they had this big finale where they like outlined the generals and had them walk through the Civil War again, and everybody would like get all up. And it's totally surreal. If you get a chance, go, because they still do it. Just go in numbers, because it's, you know, take a buddy. And okay, so anyway, so this is the first time I've actually ever read this poem, because it takes that setup. Georgia boasts the largest outcrop of granite in the world. Bald Stone Mountain, long revered by the Cherokee as holy, and now upon its face the carved icons of our defeat. Jackson, Davis, and Lee, horseback and caped in their chivalry. It took a crew of masons nearly 60 years to finish. Its scale so vast, 9 men could shelter in the nostril of a horse come rain. Backdrop of my summers spent picnicking on open fields while rednecks circled its wide base and stomper 4x4s. Each night at dusk, the laser show would beam its green technology on the face of that monumental rock, trapezoids and triangles pulsating to jazz fusion grooves, crude cartoons, the devil went down to Georgia clearly kicking young Johnny's ass. Ray Charles and Willie Nelson swapping Georgia on my mind. And in the finale, General Lee would guide us again in fluorescent relief, unsheathing his sword to lead his men at a galloping gait across battlefields laid to waste, cannons smoking, bodies slumped in dying's contorted certainty. And reckoning the cost as he measured what was lost, he broke his sword across his knee in a motion of civility. No treaties or humiliation, no surrender under an old oak tree. Just this revisionary choice, a gift, a balm, a necessary gesture sure to assuage the rebs on blankets on the lawn, whooping the nobility of it all. The first time I ever spit the word racist at my father, I was 12, head full of knowing better, heart sinking with the realization I'd continue to have that everything that I'd been told was not necessarily so. Slamming the door, I threw myself down on my Laura Ashley spread and cried like an adult for the first time in my life. In the years to come, my father and I would vary little on that racist theme when it arose, and now it hovers close enough to harm the man I love. British, Irish, Sicilian, Lebanese, no other others bothered him. Just this gelatinous mix of dark and light, us and the most nefarious of them all. It wouldn't be fair to blame my dad for what's right or wrong or old. Contempt doesn't work, as it implies disrespect I don't otherwise feel. And I'm not trying to shame or indict. It's just what, Big Legs? To be a Southerner is to feel yourself forever draped in the mantle of the past, to pull at the corners of that threadbare quilt and know its incongruity, the feet or head always left bare, exposed to the elemental cold. This is the second of the poems for Pumpkin. Forgive her, Pumpkin, Gaither's true daughter, for her first time driving, afternoon, accident, so unsure of the gas, the brake, and the clutch, just the squealing tire smoke and the aching dull thud as you crumpled into the past. I didn't know anyone could love or need me more than she did every day of her daughterless weeks. And this is the counterbalance poem to the My Dad's a Racist poem, right? So I had to sort of try to counterbalance it a little bit somehow. 3 a.m. feedings were bottled affairs, with my mother asleep and Gaither sleeping it off. So my father would rock me in the wicker chair, formula for me, red ripple wine for him, softly singing, "You are my special angel sent from heaven above," while we studied each other with drowsying eyes there in the nightlight glow. Whenever Gaither got fired, Juanita stepped in, her opposite in every way, plump and maternal and young, where Gaither was flint and gristle and wire. My love for her felt treacherous, like the day they met on accident, Gaither coming down off a drunk and showing up at our house, convinced, Juanita dusting my parents' bedroom, all shock and sweet surprise. I knew better when I saw Gaither go for her sock, saw for the first time the glint of steel in her eyes that matched that blade. I knew it was time to get her out of the house, so we went for a walk. It was my first lie to her. You don't love that so-and-so, do you? So I'm going to just read the arc of poems about leaving and being away, and that's the denouement. At the Flannery O'Connor homestead, there's nothing left of the godly writer's work, but these peacocks roosting in trees at dusk, screaming like children at the dark. When it came time, I would leave the South, trailing a U-Haul behind my mother's Cadillac and driving west till the land ran out. There's something unnameable at the point where all you see is water ahead and what you've left behind, your shadow so soon to catch up with you as the sun sinks finally down. When I miss the South the most, I'd take to dating one of its sons. Gentlemen callers who held the door with tapered fingers or rough field hands. What I was looking for was never to be found in them, just something like it, the way a lake can bring to mind, but never be the sea. This is the last poem for Pumpkin. Sepia sister of a different kind, unseen you, your absence was palpable. You should have moved 6 feet, 1 inch, 3 yards to the left, the right, into view, back into sight. You should have stayed inside, should have lived on into that night and everyone to come. You could have given her so much, should have gone to school, sharpened pencils, new lunchbox, pigtails and Mary Janes. But those are my details. In reality, you would have been wearing my sister's old clothes. Outgrown but not worn out, my mother would have said. You should have had the first crush, first kiss, first love, first loss, instead of absence and nothing again. You deserved so much more than her. I made her, I reckon I can make me another. So much more than whatever words the preacher summoned as he rained earth down on. You still deserve so much more. You should have lived. And you, I know, there is no doubt, you would have hated me. Gaither Memory, the last. Dementia meant a slow unraveling. Faces moving backwards, a siphoned creep, the digits of our number lost as the fickle past stayed past. And so we searched, landlords, kinfolk, tracking her down at an elder care home, 5 deep on cots per room. And when I walked in, she scowled at me, glaring up with just one good eye. Where the hell you been, big legs? We'd missed it all. The darkening vision, her cataract eye, the lab-coated doctors and their Medicaring ways, removing what could have been saved. And instead of a fake, she had in its place a cat's eye marble rolling around aimlessly. She gave me a tour, ignoring the leers from the pot-bellied men playing rounds of bid whist in a kitchen that reeked of the burned, before sitting on the porch for a smoke. I left her that day with money and cools and the promise that I'd be back soon. But 3 days later, we got a call from the woman who ran the place saying Gaither had just up and left, walked out without a word, and could we please come and collect the things she left behind? In the years since then, I've looked for her in phone books, hospitals, jails, the blocked text of obituaries. Before stopping my search, the desire to know weighing less than the fear of what I might find out. Maybe it's true what my mother says, that I'm being protected, that I'm not meant to know what happened to her. Maybe. Still, the child she kept sits waiting in that house, hoping she'll find her way back somehow and show up one day, convinced. Gaither Memory, every working day. Me in play clothes, her masquerading as a maid. No short black skirt and feather duster, but a stiff brown dress with white stitched pockets where she kept tissues and half-smoked ducks. Perched on top of the white deep freezer next to the ironing board, I kept her company while she did chores. Dousing water from an old Coke bottle on badly wrinkled shirts, spitting to check the iron's flat metal heat, mating socks and snapping sheets. The best part of her day was my worst, changing back into her street clothes, hanging up the uniform, bony maroni, all angles and knees in our cast-off hand-me-downs. I'd walk her to the street to wait for the bus that carried her home, 2 transfers and 3 hours later, and stand waving goodbye in the black diesel fumes while my mother called me in to eat, the supper left warming on the stove. This is the last poem. It's epilogue, and it's in 3 sections. So, the first one, epilogue 1. Pregnancy means revisiting your own past, childhood, mother. You vow things you will do differently, people you won't become. Halfway through mine, my mother calls, "You know, with my back injury, I didn't get to hold you until you were 9 months old." I think about this every day that I am pregnant, every day after my daughter is born. My mother missed